Welcome back to the Watch Well podcast. My name is Parker, and this is my co-host, Nick. Nick, how was your week?
Great week. Grandpa turned 90. For those that don't know, Parker and I are cousins, and so we share a grandpa. And we're not laughing at the 90 thing or that we are cousins. We're laughing because this is take 9 or
it's
10.
It's the 10th time. Yeah.
We're having browsers crashing and all those kind of things. So we're
things they don't tell you when you try to start a podcast.
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. No, but for those of you that don't know, here at the Watch Well podcast, we try to help you learn biblical truths by using movies. And in Acts 22:17, Paul the apostle goes to the men of Athens.
17:22.
Sorry. Thank you.
Got it reversed. Yeah.
It's been a long night. Paul goes to the men of Athens and he uses their art to introduce them to the God of the Christian faith. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're trying to emulate the Apostle Paul. So, we're glad to have you. If you're new, if you've been around, you know that Nick's answers to my, questioning how his week goes is always insufficient.
Yeah. Nothing more than good week.
Nothing more than good. It was good.
It was good.
We should make t-shirts. How was your week, Nick?
Good.
I like that.
Yeah. The small talk is not a strength of mine.
It's not. Mine either. But yeah, so this week we're going to be reviewing Titanic through the lens of truth. Mm-hmm. So at least we're going to attempt for the 10th time to record this.
Yep.
Again, so bear with us with the technical difficulties. We'll do our best. We're doing our best to grow a podcast and learn along the way. So we appreciate you guys being patient with us. So Nick, you want to do the movie rundown?
Yeah. So this movie was released in 1997, Titanic. And so Parker, you may have already known this, maybe not, but at the time, this was, so once it was done in theaters, the most watched in terms of box office movie of all time.
Yes,
so this, you know, it's been passed since then, but it's that record stood until the Avengers, the first Marvel's Endgame. Avengers.
Yep.
And then it was broken again later by Endgame, it was broken by what was The Force Awakens, I think, as well. But so this held the title of most popular movie of all time for a good chunk of years. Also the movie that kind of made Leonardo DiCaprio a star.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, so released in 97, it's a PG-13 rating. And this predates Plugged In Movie Reviews by quite a bit. So we don't really have anything for that. But Rotten Tomatoes gives it an 88% from critics. And I want to get your opinion on this because of what you told me. One of the reasons we picked this movie, Parker, was because you sent me a text, or maybe it was a conversation, I can't remember. But you said, this movie is timeless, right?
I did say that.
So, but listen to me here. Critics, 88%. So that's pretty good. It's a pretty high amount of critics that call this a good movie. But the audience score is only 69%.
Okay.
And usually, I'm asking your opinion because usually it's reversed. It's usually reversed.
Okay. I have a few things to say about that. So are you finished asking your question?
Yeah.
Or is
that's not even really a question. Just
thoughts.
Yeah.
Okay. So first thing, I think the way things are judged now on Rotten Tomatoes are different because, you know, things are more woke these days and the critics want something different than the audience. So I think that back then there was a difference in the critics and the audience seemed to trend, you know, I'm sure that there was some discrepancies, but from what I know, I believe there seemed to be a correlation. If the critics liked it, then the audience wasn't too far behind and they were closer in measurement. So in terms of that, I would say that. And then also, I don't know if there, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't know if there was this long of a movie ever before.
Oh, sure. There definitely were.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I mean, you go back to,
maybe Gone with the Wind or I don't know.
I mean, if you want to go back that far, I think Gone with the Wind is like 4 hours.
Yeah, it's a long movie.
So, I mean,
so maybe the length of the movie leads to the audience not liking it as much.
That could have something to do with it. But yeah, I feel like around this time, most movies were probably, unless you're talking Disney, but most movies were probably in the 2 to 2.5 hour. So this was long, but
this is a 3 hours and 14 minutes.
Movie. Yeah, I just don't. So, I don't know. Maybe that does impact it. I mean, I could see it impacting it. But this just stood out to me.
But 20%
what else difference?
Yeah, but what else would the audience like? What about this movie would you say is worth decreasing the audience score by that 20% in that time?
I mean, I wouldn't say anything really.
Yeah, and I watched this movie, and there's a lot of times. So we're talking 1997. So there's mm-hmm. a lot of movies from the 90s, and I don't want to creep. You know, 7 years. So from let's say 87 to 97. You're going to know that more than I would. I don't want to date myself, but
you're dating me. Yeah, you're dating me. I was born in 87 for those that care. So yeah, you're talking my first 10 years of life right now is what you're talking about.
Right, so maybe you can answer the best of your ability, but was the technological advances that great from 87 to 97?
I think Titanic.
In terms of like cameras and you know what I mean? Like this is probably the biggest movie or the new, like the, like when what, I want to say green screens, but that's not what I'm trying to say. Help me out here.
Special effects.
Yeah, special effects and CGI and that kind of stuff.
Well, the year before this was Independence Day.
Right, that's true.
So but I would say those two movies really pushed the envelope for the time.
Right. But even Independence Day, we're talking about the one with Will Smith, for those that are trying to follow the conversation here. That movie, still, when you watch it, sometimes it looks old, like it looks dated to me.
Yeah
This Titanic did. I rewatched it and I was like, you know, it's not like it was filmed this year, but I don't feel like it was old. Like it looked old with the filming and the technology, and you know, it's not the Dark Knight or it's not, you know, some of these new crazy IMAX cameras, but I didn't sometimes when I watch a movie from the 90s or even the 80s, like late 80s, it's like, oh, I can't really get into it because the technology is just not there anymore and it looks old.
Sure. Yeah. Which I can still get into it. So since we brought up Independence Day and they both have like all kinds of special effects and things like that. So just to compare, and how long is Independence Day? What, like 2.5 hours probably? Yeah. 2 hours and 25 minutes.
Yeah.
So the critic score, and this isn't what we normally do, so this is kind of a side conversation. For those that are waiting for, you know, the biblical stuff, we'll get there. Just bear with us a little bit. But
we've got to geek out.
Yeah, this is just us geeking out a little bit. So Independence Day is a 68% from critics and a 75% from audience. So the audience score for Independence Day is higher than its critic score. But for Titanic, for some reason...
But that makes sense. The critics make sense because Titanic is more like
artistic.
In my opinion, it's more artistic. It's going to win. Titanic should be the award-winning movie, right?
Yeah. And did it win Best Picture?
I can't remember.
I'll research it.
I was five.
You continue. you continue with your thought.
I was five. But no, my thought is like the critics are going to tend to like the more dramatic or the more artistic, the more screenplay, screenwriters, best actor kind of stuff. The audience just wants an entertaining movie.
Sure. Yeah.
Now, I think that those two things were closer together in that time, as opposed to now, the critics are just going to push the agenda and the audience just still wants good, entertaining stuff.
Yeah.
Those are my thoughts.
So here's you
not
are
super deep.
I think you're kind of right. You know, this is. So it looks like Titanic won Best Original Score. But I feel like the score in Titanic is just My Heart Will Go On over and over again.
Yeah, pretty much.
With different instruments at different times playing right. That melody. But
and I know it didn't. I know Leonardo didn't win anything.
No,
I think he was nominated, but he didn't win.
They won, so it won Best Original Score, Best Picture, Best Director for James Cameron, Best Visual Effects, Best Cinematography, Best Sound Mixing, which I could, you know, I don't know the technicalities or the technical side of sound mixing for a movie, but I could see that, I think. With my limited knowledge, I could see Titanic being kind of elite in that area. Best Costume Design, Best Production Design, Best Film Editing, Best Sound Editing, Best Actress, so Kate Winslet, Best Supporting Actress, which I don't know which actress they're talking about there.
Maybe the girl that played Best Supporting Actress. So it was...
So Kate Winslet would be Best Actress, and then I don't know who Best Supporting Actress would be.
Well, it would be... Hang on. I've got them up here. So it would be either Cal...
Well, that he would be actor.
So Billy Zane?
Yeah, but it's not Best Supporting Actor. It's actress.
So then my thought was Kathy Bates.
Probably.
So she played the unthinkable Molly Brown.
Yeah, there you go. That's right.
Either that or the mom.
Yeah, it would be Kathy Bates, I would think. It doesn't tell me here, but that's my guess. I didn't even. Yeah. And then Best Makeup and Hairstyling. So, you know, you might be right there that this movie's more artistic and more recognized for those things. But at like the same
when I think of critically acclaimed, I don't think of Independence Day. I think of Titanic.
No, I was just, the only reason that movie even came to mind is because it was another one of those special effects heavy movies
from the same time frame. Yes, you know, as bad as the words taste coming out of my mouth, I think the critics have it right.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
You know, that's you know, as terrible as it tastes, but I think that, and then I think the audience... I think the audience score makes sense too. Right?
You think because it's too traumatic for audiences to watch, maybe? Because you have this, like really relatable.
Well, when did Saving Private Ryan come out? Since you bring up traumatic.
99, maybe 2000.
98.
Okay.
So a year later.
But the difference between that is it's soldiers. So, and not that that shouldn't be any less traumatic, but you know, there's a scene near the end of Titanic where the boats come back and you see a mother holding her infant in her arms, frozen in the water.
So are you saying that we're conditioned to just even though it's more traumatic in nature with war, because it's war, we expect it.
So it's like, I'm not making any like claim or anything like that. I just think maybe I'm just wondering, was the, you know, you have all these, how many people have gone on a cruise? I never have, but you know, that's kind of a normal vacation for people. It's like a family vacation, and to think it might hit home more for more people to see your average everyday person on vacation in this tragic situation where they have to fight for their life and try to find a way to survive, and they really can't. It might just be a little more relatable for the average person.
I'm just going straight off of your word traumatic, because Saving Private Ryan has, the tomato meter, is it 94%?
Yeah, but that's critics.
And the audience score is 95.
Yeah, so it's high, but that's what I'm saying is...
Pretty incredible, but I mean, like, the, you know, soldiers storming the beach of Normandy and their guts hanging out
right
after the, you know, on D-Day, that's not as traumatic as, or I'm sorry, that is more traumatic than anything you see in Titanic.
But I don't think it's more emotionally traumatic. Like, I feel more emotion welling up inside of me when I watch Titanic and think about the people and their families. And you know, you had the mom telling a story to her kids as the boat's sinking, just trying to get them to stay calm. And she knows they're sinking. Her children don't. And she's just trying to tell them a story so that everything's normal, knowing they're never going to wake up again.
Like, but see, I go back to the boats. The boats, very first scene, whoom, coming in on the water. And then all of a sudden, those soldiers don't know what's... They're going to open that gate. Sure. And they don't know what's coming.
But I can't relate to that.
Fear and that... But I mean, you can just kind of imagine, you know. I mean, you just said that you were never on a boat, so how could you relate to the Titanic situation?
Because it's a parent trying to do what they can to protect their child in that moment, face to face.
I don't know,
with
man.
Impending danger, and so, and maybe that's just me, but anything and everything that is parent child centered hits me all the time. It doesn't matter what it is.
Well, I do have to agree with that a little bit, I guess, but I don't know.
But I can watch war movies and have a great time and never feel any trauma whatsoever.
Oh, see, I do all the time. I actually feel more emotion during war movies than the Titanic.
Yeah. See, and it's not, for me, it's not Titanic in general. It's just those particular scenes where it's a parent and a child.
I think what we're finding out, I'm just more of a patriot than you.
Probably.
And I like America more than you do. That's probably what it is.
Maybe. I'm not going to, I won't argue the point.
You're not going to engage?
No, I won't argue the point.
Oh, so, man.
Actually, I'll probably agree with you.
Yeah, you probably, anymore. I mean, geez, not the original America that those guys fought and died for. So that's, but there you go. That's the emotion that I feel.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
I just, like, it just causes me to put myself in that position. If, like, how do I comfort my family if I'm the only one that knows death is right there on the doorstep? Yeah, there's no way to stop it. There's absolutely nothing we can do. We're going to die, and I'm the only one that knows. And here's my family trying to go about their routine normally. Like, how am I going to handle that? And I don't know the answer to that. That's kind of a rhetorical question, but that's what pops into my mind. And that's why it hits me so hard.
So I guess we could pivot there a little bit, and we could talk about, you know, because the Bible verses, you know, I can look it up real quick if you have something else to talk about, because I didn't have this prepared. But you know what? It's going to be faster if I Google it real quick.
Yeah.
Hang on 1 second. Let me pull this up. But do you agree with the critic score and the audience score of Titanic, or do you think now that you've seen it recently, you would disagree? Like,
I'd like to see when most of the audience score comes from. Like, what's the time frame that the audience score comes from? Because I know for a while Titanic was kind of got a bad rap. Like, it was like the cool thing to hate for a little bit, for a good chunk of time. Like, excuse me, kind of like Nickelback, you know, people hate Nickelback, but somehow they sell 30 million records. Like, that you can't sell 30 million records if everyone hates you, even though everyone says they do. Like, it's kind of that kind of thing. It was the most popular movie of all time, but everyone would say they hated Titanic. So I think it just kind of became the cool thing to hate. And I think that might play into the audience rating. But I totally agree with the critic rating. I wouldn't consider it an all-time classic outside of the special effects. So not story-wise, it's not an all-time classic, I don't think. But I think it's a very good movie. I think it's very, very well made, very well acted, and worth watching. I'm glad we picked it, because I enjoyed watching it again. You got your, stuff yet?
Yeah, I'm still kind of looking for it, but we can keep talking why... I'm going to keep looking while we continue talking here. But back to my original claim about the movie being timeless. Do you agree with that, or do you disagree with that?
Yeah. After watching it, I agree. I wouldn't have thought I would say that, to be honest, because I kind of laughed.
I'm shocked that you say that too, because you did laugh.
Yeah,
you
made fun of me. I laughed at you. I was like,
I saw your
timeless Titanic. Yeah, but maybe that's because I got sucked into that cool to hate it kind of thing, and kind of it had been. So I watched it a couple days ago, and it's probably been, I don't know, 15 years, maybe 20 years since I'd seen it last. So, but yeah, after watching it again, I think it timeless. Yeah, you could watch it at any time, and it would be good.
I was just kind of shocked at how good everything. I mean, it makes sense they won all those awards. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just, it looks so good on screen.
Yeah.
It looks great.
Yeah. Which, that, That's not surprising because it's James Cameron. So Terminator, Avatar, Avatar 2.
26 years of technological advances in cinema, and it still looks that good.
But it's James Cameron.
And that's more than just what a man can do.
But he's almost single-handedly responsible for 90% of the technological advances that have come over the last several 27 years. I think the most of the, not IMAX cameras, but the standard camera that Hollywood's using now was developed by James Cameron. So like there's special effects houses that use his technology and stuff that he's had a hand in developing. So, I mean, I'm not surprised. In terms of special effects, he's the GOAT. There's nobody else that even comes close. Not Spielberg or anybody. Other people are much better on story, but when it comes to special effects, I don't think anyone else comes close.
I didn't know if I knew that it was his technology.
Yeah. So like the reason, so I think if I remember the original Avatar, there was, I think, like 10 or 15 years spent just developing the technology to be able to film it the way that they did.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's why the sequels have taken so long too, because they wanted to advance the technology even further before they filmed a sequel. So.
Yeah, I can't find this verse. It's coming up with Ecclesiastes 7:1, I think, but that's not the right one.
Okay.
But the idea was that came to mind is death is better than life. And in that situation, that's why it's so important to have your faith in Jesus and have salvation, because even though death is imminent,
you know what's coming.
Death is better than life.
Yeah, because
you're going to meet your creator. And if you raise, it's important to raise your kids up in that as well, so that you can find solace in that situation, knowing like, hey, I'm just going to make it the best I can for them, the best I can for me. We're going to read a story. We're going to be together. Mm-hmm. Death is imminent. And we're just going to, you know, fall asleep and not wake up.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
So that's what came to mind. But so I can't think of that verse.
So what
it's
comes
not Ecclesiastes 7:1.
The verse that comes to mind for me is to live is Christ and die is gain.
Yeah, that one.
Okay, that's in Philippians. I can't remember the exact, but...
That's it. I was thinking that it was somewhere around where Paul talks about giving up his salvation for the unbeliever if they believe.
Oh, that's Romans 9.
But that's Romans 9, so I didn't think it was there. But yeah, Philippians, so...
Yeah, so yeah, hanging on to faith in that moment, that's a good reminder, because, I mean, it's not likely, right, that... That's not a likely scenario to ever happen to somebody. But...
No.
But... Your faith has in that moment.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, the Bible teaches that tribulations and trials test a good faith. So if you can, in that moment, search your soul and search your, like the truest form of faith is going to remain even in that dire of a situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, so it's just heavy, but
it definitely feels heavy to me whenever, again, that scene it gets to me.
Yeah, do you think Jack was a real person? Because my wife, for those of you watching, my wife's name is Kayla, and she leaned over when she was watching it with me, and she elbowed me, and she goes, "There's a lot of people that think that old lady's crazy, and none of this actually really happened."
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts? You want to conspiracy?
Well, so hold on. Let me ask you what you mean. Do you mean like actually happened in history or from the perspective of the people in the story listening to her talk?
From the perspective of the story listening to her talk, do you think that she was just old and out of her mind and made all of this up?
No, I think it probably happened story-wise, because at the end of the movie, she pulls out the heart.
Okay.
Right, and the heart of the...
That's what I would think, too, because that would be the confirmation.
Yeah. So if that never happened, then it's kind of open, and it's open-ended, and you don't really know.
Right.
But because she pulls that out of her jacket or out of her pocket and then throws it into the ocean. I think that's the confirmation.
Right.
It really happened.
Okay, so we did that. PG-13. Let's yeah. discuss this a little bit here. So PG-13, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the only PG-13 I've seen with this amount of nudity in it.
Right.
It's not really sexual in nature, but it's still nudity nonetheless.
It's a little sexual. Not like what we see today.
Right, and that's more so what I mean. Not explicitly. Yeah. It's, you know,
but there was she's some, modeling. There was some tension. We'll call it some tension.
Tension, sure.
There was some yeah. tension. There's some tension there. You knew where it was going.
Yeah, plenty of tension. You knew
where it was going.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, so, I mean, PG-13 is probably appropriate. There's a lot of cussing, a lot of, and again, you know, right there smack dab in the middle of the movie is that nude drawing scene. So, I think 14 is probably the age I would say for this movie. Yeah, probably 14. Maybe even a little older. I don't know. I'm still fighting with myself, you know, silently
see,
in my head.
See, I think that the rating is fair, but I would not let my kids watch it until they were 15 or older.
15?
Yeah.
And what's the main reason? What I would say. Is it that
the nudity? The nudity. Mm-hmm. But see, I would be okay letting them watch the sinking and the emotional trauma parts.
Yeah.
Young.
And that, I think that's the thing there. Because I agree with you. It's just that one, 5 minute section of the movie.
Yeah, maybe not even that.
Out of 5 minutes out of 3 hours. So if you can watch the TV version where that's edited,
then I would let them watch.
Yeah,
it. And
sure.
PG-13, I think is so, very fair.
Yeah, so I watch it on Prime, which obviously is not an edited version; it's the full movie.
Right.
So,
what's the thing? Where they delete it all out?
VidAngel.
Yeah, VidAngel. Like if we had something like that, then we would do that.
And I think there's another one called Clear Play. They might not be separate anymore, but I think those are the two that I remember hearing about.
Yeah. For those that don't know what we're talking about, those two, what are they? Apps?
Services,
yeah. Something. And when you watch a movie, you turn that on and it bleeps all the words and there's parental settings, I believe. That would actually be something that, yeah. Remind me about that off air, Nick.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be something cool to review.
Mm-hmm.
I think we could do a review of that.
Yeah.
And see what that's like. That would be kind of neat.
Yeah. I've never used a service like that before.
I haven't either. So that would be kind of cool. Okay. Let's do the character rundowns real quick. So Leonardo DiCaprio plays Jack Dawson. Kate Winslet plays Rose DeWitt. Bukater?
Sure.
Bukater? I don't know.
Sure.
Cal Hockey is played by Billy Zane, and the unsinkable Molly Brown is played by Kathy Bates.
Yep.
And then Rose's mother, Ruth, is played by Frances Fisher. Yep. And that's pretty much really all you need to know.
Yeah. Well, and then one person I would add to that is the treasure hunter at the beginning, the guy that's coordinating the search, yep. Bill Paxton. He's kind of a big name. And his name in the movie's Brock Lovett. So, yeah.
So, let's just do from top to bottom here. So Leonardo DiCaprio's flawless as usual.
Yeah. You know, he's only, I think I looked it up and at 22 or 23 years old when this was filmed.
So he was a very well off. He's doing just fine at 22, 23.
Yeah. He was doing well coming off of the Growing Pains sitcom for anybody that knows that. But, this is a
Growing Pains, man.
Yeah. This is an excellent performance from him, I think.
Or debut, right?
I mean, he's been, like I said, Growing Pains, and he was in some other things before this, but this was kind of his big, this is what made him like the teen heartthrob, and then that's what propelled him into, you know, superstardom, basically. So, yeah. Yeah, he did a great job. What do you think about him?
I thought he did a good job. I thought he played the character very well. It was believable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all around well done. Crazy.
Yeah. Kate Winslet.
Kate Winslet did a good job. I mean, I don't know if we're really going to have much to say now that I think about this. Like, you're just going down the list. Good job. Good,
good
job,
job. Good job. Good job. Yeah, all the acting was stellar.
Yeah,
and I would say Billy Zane, guy that plays Cal, might have been the best. Because just in terms of making you hate him.
Yeah, I think it's a tie between him and Molly Brown.
Okay, yeah, she's really good too.
You loved Molly Brown because, and honestly, this might trigger a bunch of people, but I don't really care.
You don't care?
I don't care. Donald Trump is very relatable because he's high class, but he relates to the blue collar guy.
Sure.
And that's exactly what I thought of with Kathy Bates, her portrayal of Molly Brown. And they said that at the very beginning of the movie, if you remember, you know, she was like an overnight success with, was it oil?
I don't remember. I don't remember what.
I don't remember specifics, but I remember it was like, oh, it's
new money. Yeah.
It's new money.
Yeah.
And so that's that. I just kind of thought of that. So that's why she was the bridge between the high class individual that was Rose's mom.
Mm-hmm. Completely detached.
And then Jack.
Yeah.
And he was helping her, you know, he gave Jack the suit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. She gave Jack the suit because which is really bizarre to me that like her son, like she just happened to have that on the boat.
Just happened to have
like
his suit.
Her son.
He's not even on the boat.
But she brought her son's suit.
Yeah.
Thought that she would, you know, find just somebody from the slums in the bottom of the boat. And so, but, you know, we suspend our disbelief so that plots can, you know,
can take shape.
So, but yeah, so like, I really liked that character probably out of all of them. I thought that that was such a important character to bring to the film because without that, nothing fits. There's no connection to the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
There's no blending of the economic, separation, you know, the mm-hmm. economic privilege or whatever, the classism really, you know?
Yeah. What's her name in The Office?
Kathy Bates,
Joe.
Yeah.
I still, every time I see her, I think of that just because, you know, it's one of those shows that I watch on loop. So I think of her all the time as
she did so great. I loved that character. So they all did really well, but I agree with you. I think either Billy Zane or Kathy Bates has to be you can't have the movie without either of them. And I know that's kind of cheap to say because like sometimes when something just fits, like a production just fits, and it's like look at The Office. You replace any one of those people, it's not The Office anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't take anybody out and put in somebody different. It'd still be The Office because everybody did such a great job with their characters.
Yeah,
I think the same is here, but especially for those two.
Yeah. So then the film begins. We see the treasure hunters and, you know, the old lady who was actually a survivor just happens to see what they found and the drawing of herself and that they were looking for the diamond or whatever the jewel was. And then we go back to 1912, right? So this is where we see Rose and Cal and family and their entourage boarding the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I don't think they ever explicitly say. It's pretty clear that Rose is being basically forced into a marriage that she doesn't want, right? That's pretty clear from the get-go that she's...
Yes, I would agree with that. I would add, though, I don't think that she knew at the beginning of the movie that she didn't want it.
Right, but something that I read in preparing in a description of the movie is that it said that Rose is a 17-year-old girl whose mother has arranged this marriage because her husband passed away and without him they will lose their social status. So she's arranging the marriage, and Rose, I can't remember a time in the movie where they say her age, but she's 17 according to what I read. The character is 17 years old.
I don't think that was in the movie, but the scene where Rose is putting the corset on.
Mm-hmm.
Her mom comes in and delivers that information, if you remember.
And so, Cal is supposedly 30.
Wow.
So she's being promised to somebody 13 years older than her, who's an adult, you know, already an established person, you know, a 30-year-old man, and she's 17. But so that's in the character descriptions that I pulled from, I don't even know where I pulled it from. Probably IMDb or Wikipedia or somewhere, wherever it was. But yeah, it says Rose is a 17-year-old girl originally from Philadelphia who is forced into an engagement to a 30-year-old Cal Hockley so she and her mother, Ruth, can maintain her high-class status after her father's death and left the family debt-ridden.
Yes.
So, like, just that age gap, I think that could have even furthered the plot more if they would have explicitly pointed that out.
How so?
Because you would have known more about her hesitation. Like, what, you know, 17-year-olds being manipulated into marrying 30-year-olds, that's not necessarily a good look for the 30-year-old, right? That furthers your hatred of Cal. That furthers your hatred of her mother. Like, that's even more so that as a viewer, you want her out of that situation.
So yeah, I think that's a very good point. So you use the word hate towards the mom.
That's hatred in terms of she's acting as a villain, making here's Rose, who's essentially your main character. I mean, you could call Jack the main character, but it's really all built, the story's all built around Rose. So essentially she's your hero, right? She's the protagonist. And I know she's not like in a traditional sense, but she's the protagonist. And so everything that happens around her is villains or kind of side heroes helping her along. And her mother definitely plays the role of a villain, somebody forcing her into a situation that she doesn't want.
So I'm not disagreeing.
So that's all I mean by hating.
Right. I'm not disagreeing with your, I asked the question just to get a little bit more of what's in your head. I'm not disagreeing that her mom is not a villain for a few reasons, but the dichotomy, I think that's the correct word, the dichotomy between the two villains is interesting to me.
She has motivation.
Tell me the difference of what you see between Rose's mom and Cal as the two villains.
Well, I think I hadn't thought about comparison and contrast between the two of them, but
so because they're both villains, but they're very different villains.
Yeah, I think
they're operating out of very different reasons and motives.
Sure.
And that's what's so interesting to me because, you know, and I know we've brought this up on the podcast before, but the heart is deceitful among all things, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that it's so, so interesting that they have different motives. They're both villains. So you have Cal. How would you describe his motives that make him a villain?
Success, winning. I think he even says to Jack at some point, I always win.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Yeah. So, so
pride. I guess you could call that pride.
Yeah. I would also say, I'm just trying to make it more precise to Rose, him and Rose, because he's very much a businessman, you know, that just cutthroat, you know, even at the end of the movie where he's paying the guy off to get onto the lifeboat to save himself, just, you know, prideful, selfish. So I was trying to think of a way to communicate that more specific to Rose, because he wants Rose from the beginning. It's not only until Jack comes along that he gets territorial.
When he might lose,
right? Yeah. So, but he's still the evil guy. He's still not a good guy, regardless.
Yeah.
So I was trying to find a way. I don't know if you could.
Yeah, but even the relationship. But
my only thought was that he wanted somebody to dominate.
Yeah, and that's the exact word I was getting ready to say, was dominate.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of the creepy part when you, if this is true again, and, you know, this, you know, what I read from the description, if Rose is a 17-year-old girl who just lost her father, she's now marrying a man who treats her as if he is her father.
But even worse, right?
But he clearly recognizes that she's a child,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Because he treats her like that.
Yeah.
But he's not, he doesn't have the integrity to say, this isn't a good idea. Like he likes it. It seems like he likes that dominance power. And power.
Right.
Like he couldn't, he could not handle a godly, righteous woman. You know, for example, what it talks about in Proverbs 31 with mm-hmm. wisdom and strength. He could not handle that because he would see that type of woman as a threat, which some of those characteristics throughout the story are what Rose grows to exhibit, right?
Yes.
In right. defiance of this evil man who's trying to dominate her.
Right.
Right? So, and that's
with
what...
With more of the free-spirited contrast in Jack.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, where, you know what, we're going to take life as, you know, live simply mm-hmm. and to yourself,
yep.
you know, and help others more open yeah. to that. So
he just can't handle any challenge to his...
Right.
His pride, to his dominance, to his power, authority. Like, he has to have final say over everything. And like he tells Jack, he has to always win.
Yeah, so, yep. Yeah, so we've talked about a lot of that. So let's contrast that with the mom.
Yeah.
Complete fear, the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So you have power and you have fear.
Mm-hmm.
And they're completely opposite, but they're yep. both villains.
Yep.
And I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah.
I thought that was so interesting because she is terrified to be the lesser human in her, like in kind of in her own words and actions and how she treats Jack as inferior,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of the, what would you call it? The privilege of her last name based off of her husband's wealth.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't even say wealth, right? Just his so, name.
Given the time frame, so early 1900s,
mm-hmm.
Do you think that maybe, and this again isn't prepared at all, this is just kind of an off-the-cuff thought, do you think that maybe their motivations are actually the same? And so they're both motivated by power and dominance, but we're seeing the contrast or the difference in the way they're actually responding. She's responding in fear. He's responding in pushing and being domineering. Right. Is yeah. that just the different ways that men and women naturally respond to a loss of power? Or when they're faced with that loss of pride or selfishness, a woman might respond more in that fearful way and try to manipulate things into a proper outcome for themselves. Whereas a man, again, and I'm not saying one is bad, they're both desperately sinful, but the man is going to be naturally be drawn to be more domineering when they sense that loss of power or a hit to their pride coming. They're going to be more forceful in the way they respond.
Okay, so I'm going to say something that may come out wrong, but I okay. think that the male, what you're, I might agree with you.
Okay. But you just but don't I know
think, yet. No. I might agree with you, but I think the male version of what you're saying is more sinful than the female one.
Okay, can you explain
the
that?
Reason why? The reason why is because I think that men have a duty to protect women.
Sure.
Just as a general, you know, statement, mm-hmm. women and children, no differently than we see on the boat. That's why protocol is, you know, women and children first.
Yeah. And
right?
He violates so that protocol, right?
He violates that too. So I think that I would be more apt to say that it's less sinful and more of a, like, especially in that time, I need to be taken care of and no one is.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to do something.
Yeah, I have to figure something out.
Or I'm going to have nothing. I'm literally yeah. going to die. I'm going to have nothing. I'm either going to die on the boat
I'm going to
die of starvation, be a peasant. Yeah. So I think that.
I can't be down in the lower levels of the boat. I've got to be up right. in the penthouses and in the best rooms and all
right.
that.
Right. So
yeah.
I think that there is, so if we're just talking about the initial nature of that, I think it's actually a defense mechanism for good things, like for good intent. But how she goes about it and how she discriminates based off of class is more of what makes that sinful in the movie and for her character mm-hmm. than Cal. Because yeah. Cal is just all negative. It's all sinful. It's all about making himself a god almost, the power, yeah, right? Sure. Definitely. So I always win. Ordering everything people around, I do is right. I'm ordering people. I'm in control, and I can pay my way through.
I'm smarter than you.
Yep.
Because you know,
so that, I think that.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, you're fine. I that was kind of the end of the thought, but I think that. Yeah, I think that I tend to give more grace, or at least the very beginnings of those actions, decision making, whatever you would call that, the beginning of that, I think one is not inherently sinful and the other is. One's I need to protect myself because no man is protecting me, which I don't know if you could say is sin, and the other is just completely sinful arrogance.
Well, I think you can say it's sin because it's pretty clear that it comes from a place of, and not even just in the movie, but just, so I'm kind of jumping away from Ruth when I'm talking about it, but the motive to do that is kind of, it has to be coming from a lack of faith. Like wherever that,
in terms of that,
loss,
yes.
So I
guess I'm just sinful, looking at the defense of, you know, because you can have all the faith in the world, but part of honoring God is using your brain and strategy and
sure.
And you know having an emergency fund for lack of a better description. So if you don't have that, yes, you know, God's gonna provide, but He also gave me a brain to make good decisions,
yeah,
and provide for myself and do those things now. You know, how you, the degree in which you discuss those or think about those, you know, maybe can be debated, mm-hmm. but I still believe that the inherent or the littlest form of like, I have to do something.
I have to strategize to fix it. Right.
And I have to strategize for our future. I don't know if I can say that that's sinful.
Yeah. So no,
now,
not
now,
that.
Now,
but
putting people down in a box of you're lesser than me after that thought. Yeah. Is completely sinful.
Or saying, I can't sink to your level. I can't
Correct.
Sink to the
All
level
of
those
sin.
People. And then
All of that, yes.
using your daughter as a pawn to maintain mm-hmm. your own social status. Yeah.
Yeah.
All mm-hmm. of that is...
All of that is condemned.
Yeah.
Should be condemned.
But yeah, so... Yeah, that's actually pretty interesting because I would have... Without you asking to compare the two, I don't think I would have even thought in those terms. But yeah, that's really interesting. Right.
Yeah, so we have, I don't know if you have, man, dang it.
What?
I don't see your recording.
It says I'm recording.
It says live video will return when their internet improves.
It tells me I'm recording.
No, it says we're both recording, but I don't see your video.
Oh, well, we're probably still recording.
Okay.
Because remember, it can record. It's not recording the live feed.
Okay, so just keep going then.
Yeah, just keep going.
Okay, we can edit all that out, I guess.
Yeah.
But so did you have the next thing to the next, I guess, point in the movie, Nick?
You mean in the like flow of events?
Yeah. Or,
so then the next thing we see is Jack. He's in a poker game.
Right. Right.
So he's playing poker. He wins the Titanic tickets 5 minutes before it's getting ready to depart. And him and his friend Fabrizio jump up and run and try to board the Titanic. And that's where we learn about Jack. He stands up and says, I'm going home. And the other guy says, I'm going to America. And, you know, all of that stuff. So, and then... just by chance. So actually, this is another side conversation that I wanted to bring up as it relates to that. And I think this is going to be interesting because it's not just about Titanic. It's kind of about all stories in general. And the point that I'm kind of going to make is in story writing or in filmmaking, I guess maybe is the better way to say that, does the screenwriter play the role of God? And I've got more that I want to say in relation to that. So if you were to compare creating a story mm-hmm. to the way the world functions in general, does a screenwriter in creating a story play the role of God? Does that even make sense to you?
Like, I think it makes sense, but I don't know how to answer it because, oh man, that's going to be hard to communicate. Let me try to get through this. I might fumble here a little bit, but.
And I'll tell you specifically in Titanic where this comes from.
In a human sense, from our perspective, I would say yes.
Okay.
But outside of that, I would say no, because we can only repeat what the creator has created.
Sure, yeah. So I guess—
Is that fair?
That's completely fair. And I guess to try to clarify a little bit what I mean is, maybe it's better to say, is the existence of screenwriting and the fact that a screenwriter exists proof that we were made in the image of God? Maybe that's an even better way to say it. And so let me just—
I would say that for all creative arts.
All creative arts. You know, okay.
I would say that for all creative arts, because we were made in the image of God, therefore God creates, therefore we must create.
So
we create at a lesser degree because we're fallen.
Right. And we can only use what God has already created that is in existence, right? We can't bring something out of nothing like as God
does. Right.
But so starting here, there's all of and this is true of any story, right? You go to a movie, you sit in the theater seat or at home on your couch, you know fundamentally that what's in front of you is all 100% planned and coordinated, right? You know that.
And used before.
You know that it's somebody wrote it, somebody then filmed it, somebody set the stunts, there's stunt doubles. You know all of these things. You know it's all coordinated.
Yeah, there's going to be an intro, it's going to work to a climax, and then it's going to come down, and then there's going to be a reveal, there's going to be maybe a couple of switches, and then it's going to conclude.
Yet, when you're watching a movie, if it's done well, it feels like it's actually happening. It's designed to create an experience where you feel like it's actually taking place. And so I'm going to kind of use that analogy. So in Titanic, right, you have Jack just happen to win Titanic tickets in a poker game.
I know where this is going.
Right? Just happened to win these tickets. And when you're watching it, it feels like it was really by chance. Okay? And then you have Jack get on the boat. They just happen to make it in time. And then you have Jack just happen to look up to his right at the exact time that Rose stormed out of the room.
Angry.
To get some air and get out onto the deck. Just happens to see her and glance up, right? It just happens.
And then notice Cal's disgust.
Disgust,
with her.
Yep. And then the next time, Jack just happens to be laying on the deck of the Titanic with his, you know, laying there on a bench as Rose just happens to be running right past that bench to go jump off the boat to commit suicide. And then Jack, this person who has no idea who she is other than the fact that he just happened to see her before, runs up and just happens to convince her not to go, which then just happens to propel them into this 24-hour romance in which Rose is freed from, you know, the clutches of her domineering fiance and mother and what, and for so all of these things that are happening seemingly by chance, yet somebody decided that it would happen that way. When we're in it, when you're watching, you feel like this was actually just by chance. You feel like it was actually just an occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody planned it exactly that way. The screenwriter wrote it that way. So kind of just to compare that to our experience in life, in the world, if we look at our life as a story, there's so many things that we think happen by randomness. It just happened just by chance. Happened to, you know, and I'll use me and my wife as an example. My church that I was going to that was meeting in a YMCA just happened to get a phone call from a pastor to say, hey, do you want our building? And that building just happened to have a group of people that were still worshiping there. And my wife, future wife, just happened to be one of those people that were worshiping at that building. So we said, my church just happened to take that building and we just happened to merge those two churches together, and we just happened to sit close to each other at a dinner and just happened to meet each other because these seemingly unconnected, unplanned, random events happened in a way that caused us to meet each other.
Right? Oh, can I play? I want to play.
Yeah.
Can I play?
Do it. Yeah.
Okay, so we obviously we're cousins.
Yeah.
I grew up in Indiana, right? Yeah. My dad just happened to get a job promotion. Just happened that my mom was okay moving. Just happened that my parents moved to Ohio and picked a school system, a public school system in that area. Just happened to find a baseball team that was not affiliated with that school system. Just happened that all of the players on that team went to a local Christian school. Just happened that my dad was trying to sell one of his cars throughout this entire time, would not sell, just happened, finally sold, just happened to be enough to pay my tuition for the first year of that school. Just happened that that school also contained my wife. Just happened, like, it's the same, it's kind of the same idea.
It's the exact same story. There's all these things that just seem to happen by chance, that seem to happen by randomness. Yet, if you take us, just like we can do with a story that we watch on a screen, if you take a step back and think about that story, think of yourself as in a story. There's a screenwriter. There's a master storyteller who's crafting all of these things together. And the Bible says that he's working all things together for good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. So that even takes us to like even the bad things that seem to happen by chance.
Well, and we're going to have to get into that for those that I think you're opening a huge can of worms.
Oh, I'm sure I am. But so just like for the film, that often unspoken reality is that a screenwriter decided and determined exactly how all of these events would play out. Yet when we watch it, we feel like it's just happening by chance. Same in our life, we feel like all of these things are random or just by chance. But we have an ultimate master storyteller who's crafting it all together for his glory and for the benefit of those who love him. So just to see that, and I think in my mind, the book of Esther in the Old Testament is probably the best example of that, because there's so many things
God's working behind the scenes.
He's never mentioned, right? He's never mentioned at all in the book. There's never God said this or God did this. It's just the events playing out seemingly at random, right? The king just happens to choose Esther to be his queen, right? And, you know, Mordecai just happens to uncover a plot to save the king and gain the favor of the king. And then it all, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff that is similar to that. It just happens to be the case. You know, there was just one night where the king just happened to not be able to sleep. So he wanted to read in the books about, you know, the works that people have done. And he just happened to read about Mordecai and remember what Mordecai had done. And so like all of these things just happen, yet God is behind the scenes working them all to bring about a positive solution for his people. And I just think this movie, for some reason, I don't know why, maybe it's just that sequence of events at the beginning of the movie or near the beginning of the movie, but that really hit me when watching Titanic.
So let's address the elephant in the room here.
Oh boy.
Just for those who are watching, Nick, you couldn't be talking about predestination, could you?
I could be. I could be.
So then let's ask the obvious question. Mm-hmm. What about free will?
Well, we have to.
Are you? And I'm kind of helping the conversation here. Are you saying that Jack was forced to help her, that Rose was forced to jump, that forced to think about jumping, or was all of this? Are we robots?
I believe. So this is going to sound like a contradiction. But I think if we really focus in on the Bible, it's not a contradiction, Rose 100% chose that she was going to go jump. But at the same time, there was never any other outcome possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that I know that can seem like a contradiction, but I think both are true. And we struggle to think, okay, in order for it to be a choice, then there has to be, then that outcome, that it, there has to be an option to where I would have chosen the other thing, right? But you didn't choose the other thing, right? You still chose, but you didn't choose the other thing. Why do you need to believe that you could have chose the other thing?
Mm-hmm.
You chose this. And at the same time that you chose this, it is exactly what God ordained to take place. That's mm-hmm. called compatibilism. That's we choose, but there's also not, the other thing was never going to happen.
Right.
Both things are true. So in terms of, do you have a will? Yes, you have a desire for things and you choose in accordance with what desire you have. But at the same thing, it's not going to come to pass unless it plays into what God has decreed and what he has determined will happen for his glory and for the good of those who love him. The Bible says exactly that, that God works all things for the good of those who love him. And you can look at Joseph in the Old Testament and his being sold into slavery, right? And he says to his...
Yeah. Who sent Joseph to Egypt?
Right.
Right.
Right. And yep. he says to his siblings, the very ones that sold him, what you meant against me for evil, God meant for good. And so the brothers had intent. They had desires and they chose in accordance with their desires. But at the same time, God meant and had intention for that exact same event. And there's not another reality where Joseph doesn't get sold into slavery.
And I think it's interesting that the way you're communicating it, because I would have communicated that God, and maybe it's the same thing, but God allowed the evil to happen so that his plan and his kingdom could be furthered.
Mm-hmm.
And that might also sound backwards too, because why would God allow evil? So I'm interested to know what you would think about that. Why would God allow evil?
Well, evil is already the status quo in our world because of mm-hmm. sinful man. Evil right. is the status quo. So without God acting, we are thrust into complete and utter chaotic evil all the time. But because God acts and directs things for his purposes, it actually restrains the evil that we see in the yes. world. It actually
yeah.
reduces the amount of evil that we're subjected to while we're here on earth, in the world that he created. So,
let's jump to another question here. And this is all just off the top of my head too, because yeah. what I get a lot is, okay, so if predestination exists, then with the fall, did God force Adam and Eve to fall?
And that's a good question. You know,
and I think that trips a lot of people up for the whole predestination thing.
Right. I think he planned for it. He had in some fashion, he planned for it because Ephesians chapter 1 tells us predestined before the foundation of the world. Mm-hmm. Right. So before the foundation of the world, this plan was in place. So in some fashion, he had a plan for it. But we don't. But what the Bible doesn't really tell us is, what was Adam and Eve's nature, right? The Bible is full of things that communicate to us that we have inherited a sin nature because of their sin. And from the moment that Eve was deceived, okay, Adam sinned. Sin entered the world through Adam. If you read Romans chapter 6, it talks about this, that through one man, sin entered the world, and through that came death. Okay, so through Adam, sin entered the world. So we inherit our sin nature from the sin of Adam, and we inherit our guilt and our condemnation from the sin of Adam. And so we are totally depraved. We have a sinful nature apart from Christ. We are lost in that sinful nature. And when we choose sin. when you ask a person who is lost in sin, what do they want to do? Their answer is sin. Okay, that's because we have a corrupt nature because of that. But the Bible doesn't really tell us what was the nature of Adam and Eve before they sinned. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't talk about their nature. It talks about they were good, you know, and God created them together, and it talks about them becoming one, and that was very good, right? Their union was very good, but it doesn't specifically address the issue of their nature, right? So did God, we know that God allowed the serpent to be there, the thing that tempted Eve, and he is God. He could have said, no, that's not going to be in the garden, right? So we know on some level that just like what you said, he allowed it. So, but we don't know, I guess we don't know exactly what Adam and Eve's nature was. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I'm actually looking up a verse right now. Sorry.
I wouldn't by any means consider myself an expert on the topic. So, if somebody wants to comment, feel free to disagree.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Join the conversation. So you said Adam sinned, the woman didn't sin, she was deceived.
Yep. She was deceived.
What would you call it? What would you call sin? Would you use that word synonymous with transgression?
Sure.
So to counter your point a little bit here, because I had always understood the fall as the woman was deceived and sinned, but Adam bore the responsibility. And in 1 Timothy chapter 2, starting in verse 14, well, let's start in verse 13, says, "For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Mm-hmm. Yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith, love, and holiness with self-control." So I don't know if we can say that Eve didn't sin, and I may be getting you on a technicality here.
Yeah.
So I offer that. Because I still think your point stands, mm-hmm. but I think that, you know, if you look at the punishment, Adam was passive, Eve sinned and subverted her duty to following her husband. And there's a hierarchy there between God, man, and woman, and not that women are inferior. It's just the gender roles that God created, the hierarchy that, you know, our God is a God of order, and man is the head of the woman, you know, in a union, and Christian marriage and all of that. So the way I understood it was the woman was deceived and mm-hmm. became a transgressor, but Adam bore the responsibility, which is why sin enters the world through man.
Yeah.
Is that incorrect?
No, I don't think that's incorrect, but I don't think that Adam necessarily bore the responsibility for Eve's deception or Eve's action. I think that Adam, in his following Eve's lead and taking of the fruit himself, is what threw the world into sin and death. Because Adam there was faced...
That's interesting.
So that's... Adam there was faced with an option because... So Romans... I'll read Romans 12. Or not Romans 12. Okay, I said Romans 6, but it's actually Romans, the end of Romans 5. So therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned, for sin indeed was in the world before the law was given, but sin is not counted where there is no law. Yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sinning was not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. Okay, so I'm just gonna stop there for a second, and focus in on that, a type of who was the one to come. We call Adam the first man. He is the first Adam. Christ mm-hmm. is the second Adam, right?
Correct.
So
correct.
Adam, the first creation.
Because earlier it's like death, death in Adam, alive in Christ. You're mm-hmm. either of Adam or you're of Christ.
Right. So then, Jesus did something that Adam didn't, because he is a second yes. and better Adam. So
yes.
If you put yourself, and some of this comes from a book called Death by Living, and it's not necessarily a theological book, but this is just a thought to get us thinking about how this all happened. So don't take this as precise theology, but just allow this to think and kind of form what you're thinking about as we talk about it. So Adam there is confronted with the fact that his wife has eaten of the fruit that God told Adam would cause them to die, right? Mm-hmm. God told Adam, he talks about before Eve was even formed, do not mm-hmm. eat of the tree in the midst of the garden, for if you do, you will surely die, right? That's what yes. God tells Adam. We have no record, doesn't mean that he necessarily didn't, but we have no record in Genesis of God telling Eve the same thing.
Right? And the way I understood it was God told Adam, and it was Adam's responsibility to communicate to Eve.
Sure. Yeah, and I think that's a good way to view it. And then when the serpent tempts Eve, he tempts with, did God really say?
Yes.
Right? And then
Eve, surely you won't die.
But then Eve said, we aren't to eat of it or do what? Touch it.
Or touch it.
But God didn't say that. So where did Eve get that? I don't think
from Adam.
I don't know that. I don't, you know, that's one way to think about it, because God didn't say don't touch it. God said don't eat of it. And so you could legitimately potentially make an argument that, you know, this instruction came from Adam as a safeguard, right? But that safeguard didn't actually come from God. So what was Eve to do there? And Adam might have even played into their Eve's deception a little bit, if that's the case. But then so now Adam, once Eve eats of the fruit, the serpent, you know, convinces Eve that it's good. She says it's it looks pleasurable and good to eat, and she takes a bite. And then she gives a piece to her.
Well, hang on. I want to throw something in here too, okay. Because she was also tempted by the fruit itself.
Sure. Yeah.
Because I think good. That's important.
It
too,
looked good.
Because it looked good. And it specifically says in verse 6 of Genesis 3, it says, and the tree was to be desired to make one wise.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And what do we see often? We see us leaning on our own understandings. And yep. there's the opposite of that is what should be, you should lean on God's understanding. So
yeah, sure. Yeah, that's a good point.
So I just wanted to add that.
Yeah. So, and then Eve eats of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yep. then Adam is handed a piece, or handed the whole thing, whatever. And Adam right then has a decision to make, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that Adam didn't do that Christ did do?
You want me to answer?
Sure. It's rhetorical, or maybe not rhetorical. You can answer it if you have an answer.
I would say that Adam's responsibility is to his wife in that moment.
Yep.
And he should die for his wife.
Yep. Christ was a sinless substitute for us, who took the penalty of sin upon himself, right?
Yes.
Adam.
But Adam didn't. He was passive.
Adam at this moment is
it
sinless.
It was the woman.
Adam at this moment is sinless because yes. he's handed the fruit. He hasn't eaten of it yet. So he's looking at his wife, right? He's looking at the woman who he said, flesh of my flesh and bone of my bones, right? He's mm-hmm. he's singing songs about his love for her. Okay, he's looking at his wife, and his wife is going to die. So Adam has a choice to make. He can die instead and save his wife, or he can join her in death. And he chose to join her in death.
Yes.
Because at that moment, he was still sinless. So Adam, there in that moment, is a sinless, potential sinless substitute for his wife. Yet, instead of doing that, he chooses the desirable fruit rather than the salvation of the woman he loves.
That's awesome.
Rather than the salvation of his bride. And then Christ made the exact opposite decision.
Mm-hmm.
Confronted with the sin of his bride, he says, take me instead.
Yeah, you're right. That's very well put together. That's awesome. That's exactly right.
So Christ, the second Adam, the second and better Adam, why is he better? He's better because he did what Adam couldn't or wouldn't.
Yeah. Which goes back to the original conversation of, you know, God orchestrating everything.
Yeah.
And why does evil exist?
Yeah. If God just freely said, man, do whatever you want. Do whatever your heart desires. Well, what does a deceitfully wicked heart desire?
Sin.
Sin. So if God removed himself and said, man, I don't want to override your free will whatsoever. I don't want to do anything that might hinder you in doing what you please. The results of that are catastrophic for the world.
Yes. Like,
if God said, do what you want, and I'll be here when you want me, no one's ever coming to him. No right. one's ever going to want him. No one's ever going to be saved. No one's ever going to be redeemed. No one is ever going to experience anything good whatsoever in their life. Even, you know, the Bible talks about common grace, right? God sends mm-hmm. the rains, and, you know, the believers and non-believers alike get the same rain, right? On their crops. A believing farmer gets rain on his crops and the crops grow. An unbelieving farmer gets rain on his crops and the crops grow and he can feed people, right? If God removes his grace, if God removes his intervention, overriding man's evil hearts and evil free wills, and the result is nothing but chaos. We take something that can have some semblance of order and insert nothing but chaotic violence. That's the result of God removing himself and allowing man just to act in his free will. Violence. I do what I want all the time. We get an extreme version of Cal in Titanic. I always win. Yep. I always get what I want. I'm going to put myself in the place of somebody else who actually needs the spot on the boat.
Well, it's the knowledge of good and evil, and we will be like God.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we sought after, right?
Yep.
So we become God. That's what the heart of man wants, is to be God.
Yep. Exactly. And in doing that, we run after sin in our corrupt nature. When we do what we want, we sin.
Yeah,
when
man,
God pulls us back and gives us grace, that's when we don't sin.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that right there is a good stopping point for at least that discussion, because mm-hmm. we could do a whole podcast on the next discussion from there.
Yeah, for sure.
But let's go back to, now I'm kind of thinking, and this might be dumb.
Okay.
You can tell me if it's dumb, okay? And if it's dumb, you can post down in the comments.
All right.
But do we see that grace with Molly Brown?
Can you explain what you're thinking a little bit? Because maybe, but I don't really know where you're going.
You have judgment from mom. You have the sinful pride and self-worship of Cal. And Molly Brown's the one that comes and says, I don't care who you are, you're going to that dinner. You have a seat at the table.
Sure. You have a seat at the, yeah.
You have a seat at the table.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you my son's tuxedo.
Oh, man.
So you can have a seat at the table. You can have a seat at the table.
Yeah. Yep.
What do you think of that?
Yeah. I think that's really cool, because we are clothed.
We can put on Christ,
yep,
and have a seat at the table.
We're clothed in his righteousness and accepted. Yeah, sure. You could say that.
You can do something there.
Yeah.
Pretty close. Thought that was cool. That one just hit me.
Yeah.
Did you have anything else?
No, not really. Just some other things that I thought was kind of interesting is, could you actually, so it's a romance, right? The core story. it's a romance between Jack and the development of that romance.
Well, I think it's one of two things. I think it is a romance, but I also think it's like a coming of age, and even even more so now that you told me that she's only 17.
Yeah,
but it's a finding who you are and becoming an adult and really just you know, not maybe in like the spiritual sense, but in a personal sense of like seeking your heart's desires, not like negatively. Mm-hmm. Is that coming across fine? You know, not. I mean, you just did this whole sermon on
the heart,
on the heart, and how it's, you know, what does a, you know, deceitful, wicked heart want? But we do have our own desires that are healthy, that are, and this is not in contrast to that. It's just a different conversation in context. And I think that that's part of the movie too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess, the question that comes from that...
You were going to go somewhere with romance.
Yeah, it's a question. Can you call what Jack and Rose have love? And if so, if yes, why, no, why?
I would say, I think... I mean, I know where you're going with this.
I'm not really going anywhere, I'm just asking.
I would say, okay, so there's a little bit of a long-winded answer. I would say yes. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if that one's tough. So the obvious answer is yes, because he laid down his life for her.
Yeah. Even though there was probably room for both of them.
Yeah. That's funny. I've seen that before.
Yeah, I get what he laid down his life for her. So you're talking Ephesians.
That's the obvious answer.
Yeah,
but Ephesians 5. At the same time, I don't know if I would say that is. So let me ask you this question, because maybe I don't know. Is there a difference in love towards a spouse versus towards anyone else?
Yeah.
Because yes, they were romantic, but me dying for my wife is different than me dying for you.
Right.
Would you agree with that?
But we also have both Bibles.
There's no greater love than one that lays down his life for another, right?
For his friends, yeah.
Yeah. So is there a difference?
Yeah. So we have both verses, right?
But there's a difference in love. There's the four different types of love, but does it just come down to that?
Yeah, I think there's, so, yeah, and that's kind of where I was going with the question, and I don't think I have a good answer, but, so, what I look at in Titanic, what I want, or advise, let's say, somebody to model their dating relationship, and I think the answer is no. I think everyone knows that it's kind of that way. But would I want to model friendship? If I take out the romantic aspects of it, would I want people to model their friendship of people after Rose and Jack? For sure. Because when Jack is in trouble and can't help himself, who runs to his rescue? Rose. She risks her life to run and try to help him and get him out, and eventually does, preserving his life a little bit longer. And then when the boat's sinking, who's leading the way, leading the charge, putting himself at risk at all times, doing whatever he can to make sure Rose survives? Jack. And that's exactly what we should be doing for our brothers and sisters in Christ, our friends, people we're close to, family members. And I know that's something that you're pretty passionate about, is that protection aspect of the mm-hmm. calling of men, right?
Yeah.
That's definitely something we should be doing. We should be willing to lay ourselves down for the good of those we care about, for the good of those around us. Just like we said, greater man has no love than this, that he lays his life down for his friends. So modeled in Jesus is exactly what he did. And we can see an example of that kind of love in Rose and Jack as well.
And that's exactly what I was going to say, is I look at, if you take the romantic stuff out of it, then that's exactly how a friendship should work. But mm-hmm. I wouldn't put it on the same level as a marriage, because there's been no oath before God. There's been no vow. Those things are definitely are different. So,
yeah,
that's why I had a little bit of trouble with the question. But
yeah, sure. Have you ever watched How I Met Your Mother?
I've seen it, but I would not be able to do any trivia.
Okay, so this was another joke I made to Katie because we watched we've watched the first season recently, and just a couple days before watching Titanic, they're at a friend's wedding, and this is, do you know the character Victoria at all? Does that ring a bell for you?
Mm-mm.
Well, she has this theory that, you know, so they, Victoria and Ted, the main character, they meet each other and they hit it off immediately, but they refuse to start a romance. They refuse in the moment to start any type of actual romance because she has a theory that, you know, when you have this instant chemistry, this instant like attraction to somebody, you ruin it if you go beyond the day. Like if you go beyond that moment, you ruin it.
Is this right? When Ted tells her he loves her too early?
I can't remember if that happens or not. It's at a wedding and she, and so like they're going in to kiss and it's like this slow buildup, but she tells him to close his eyes. And they never actually kiss because she runs off with his eyes closed. And the theory is we'll always have that perfect moment. The anticipation, the buildup, we'll always have that perfect moment. And that's the reason I bring that up is because I thought it was kind of fun. And that's what Rose has. She has this 48-hour romance with this guy named Jack. Who knows if Jack survives, maybe they get married and then get divorced after a year. Right? Like, so she has this preserved memory, this perfect moment for all time that can never be corrupted in her mind
outside
because of how
dying.
Wonderful, right? outside of him dying, but that romance,
but that adds to it, yeah,
right. It can never be corrupted. Whereas if he survived, maybe they stay together, maybe they don't, maybe they grow to hate each other, maybe, you know, like all of those things. I just thought it was interesting. Thought that the movie's an example of that.
That's really good, man. Anything else?
No,
I've got one final point. It's kind of elementary, I guess, but it's maybe it's not. I don't know, but I wanted to talk about the idolization of the boat itself.
Yeah,
and I wanted to talk about like what they say in the movie. It's the unsinkable ship.
Unsinkable,
right?
Yeah,
and it just kind of made me think about how we live our lives, you know, with, you know, idolatry of ourselves and idolatry of celebrities and our entertainment and putting our entertainment before, you know, our morals and our beliefs as Christians and, you know, just being a part of the world, just blending in. And I don't know, it just kind of made me think that we start to believe these things will be enough to save us. You know, in terms of how we worship them, you know, people may not think that they're worshiping something, but if you're putting it above your salvation, if you're putting it above, you know, your relationship with Christ, then that is a form of worship and it's sinful and it's not going to save you. It's sinkable. It is truly sinkable. And I would just encourage everyone to, you know, kind of, you know, It may trigger you. It may not. You may think that Christians are crazy. You may think that we're crazy. But just really, really sit down and think about like morality. And one of the things that got me was that every sin that ever will be committed, that ever has been committed, is being committed, or ever will be committed, is either paid through Jesus or will receive judgment through a righteous God. And so we can rejoice in that, knowing that nothing will not get what it deserves. And so they worshiped the boat. They said it was unsinkable and it sunk. Mm-hmm. And if you have faith in Jesus, that's a boat that won't sink.
Mm-hmm. It's unsinkable.
So
yep.
Those are my final thoughts, man.
Yeah. Awesome.
I know we had a lot of troubles through this episode, Nick. I had a blast with this one. It was actually a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be outside of the technical difficulties. Maybe you're right. We should do a a behind the scenes
blooper.
Just us saying the same things over and over again with the internet crashing. But I appreciate you, and we appreciate you guys for sure. We definitely appreciate you guys listening. We hope it gives you guys value. Don't be afraid to engage with us. We're trying to create more engagement. You know, leave comments, join the discussion. It does help with the algorithm and push us to more people, and that's really what we need. We need more people. We need more subscribers. If you're watching this and you're not subscribed, please think about, consider subscribing. You know, it's our mission here to reach more people, to get conversation going, discourse going, to, you know, help the apologetic or the defensive of the faith. So if you are a Christian, come on, just share it with other people, other Christians, because we really want to use these movies to help others communicate the defense for their faith. And I know, Nick, I'm sure you went through this. I went through this. It's empowering when you start to think critically about this stuff and get to know the Bible more, and can look at the opposition in terms of the arguments and be able to refute that and rely on God's word, stand on God's word to do that. You know, and the apostle Peter says, Peter says every man will have to give an account for their faith. And it's just super empowering to be able to do that. Do you have any other final thoughts, Nick?
No, I think you nailed it.
Awesome.
I think we're good.
All right, guys, we'll see you next time. Go watch a movie.